This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome once again to one of our talks behind the scenes, the Curator's Talks. The Friends are delighted to bring these talks to you, and I know that you really do enjoy them. And today we've got quite a treat because we've even got some show and tell, and I believe it might even be show and tell and smell as well. Today we've got Curator Alison Mercer to talk about material collecting during archaeological investigations of Macassan trepan, which is sea cucumber, which is in the containers there. And we're also have to thank Patria Kay for allowing us to have these things here today, and for also for helping us set up the wonderful display. And these were harvested on the coast of Northern Australia.
Yep.
So anyway, over to Alison to tell us all about them. And thank you once again for coming.
Thanks, Alison. Thank you, Caroline. And thank you all for coming today. I know you've braved the cold to be here, so thank you. And I'd also like to thank Patria and Matt in Cons and Registration for making the objects available for you to see today and, as Caroline said, look at, touch, sniff, play with, if you desire. So, yes, today I'll be introducing you to the Australian Journeys Macassan Trepang Fisherman Exhibit. And I'll be introducing you to the objects that I've selected to help tell the story of the Macassans in the gallery. And I thought it would be, even though the blurb did specify that it would be just about sort of the archaeology of the Macassans in North Australia, I thought I might expand out from that and give you introduce you to more of the objects that I'll be putting in there, just to give you a more rounded picture of the exhibit. And also because, pardon me, we don't actually have many of the archaeological objects for you to see today, and I'll explain why. I think unlike most of the talks in this series, the Macassan exhibit is made up entirely of loan objects. So we are in fact lucky to have some of them here already today for you to see. Sorry. And I guess this is a good opportunity then to thank some of the lenders for their support, because without it we wouldn't be able to tell some of Australia's important stories, historical stories. So I don't want to really bore you with the ins and outs of exhibition development, but I think a healthy lending program is important to what we do as curators, and allows us to tell stories that we wouldn't otherwise be able to tell, such as this Macassan story, because in the National Historical Collection we have very little that would help us tell this story, even though it is a wonderful collection that we have. The archaeological material, some of which we're lucky to have today, is loaned from the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory, or MAGNET. And I'll refer to it as MAGNET throughout the talk. We also have material loaned from Emeritus Professor Campbell McKnight, and he's been researching the Macassans for some 40 years. He knows a lot about them. We also have loans coming in from the National Gallery and also the National Museum of Ethnology in the Netherlands. So unless, you know, it's a great way also of bringing objects to new audiences. So unless you were planning a trip to the Netherlands sometime soon, you wouldn't happen to see, you wouldn't be able to see the object that we're getting from there. And I'll introduce you to that object and the others as the talk progresses. So before the first fleet arrived in Sydney in 1788, fishermen sailing from the port of Macassar in modern-day island of Sulawesi were sailing to the Arnhem Land coast of northern Australia to collect trepang, otherwise known as sea cucumber or bêche de mer. Just how long before is debated. The precise year of the voyage, the first voyage, is not known from the historical or the archaeological records. The consensus among historians and archaeologists has been to place the date of the first voyage in the first half of the 18th century. Whether or not the voyages were made annually at this point in time is uncertain. However, recent studies of trepang imports and exports to and from Macassar suggest that the 1720s, the trepang industry was still in its infancy. And as the century went by, the industry intensified, and so the fishermen were sailing further and further afield to supply the demand. A recent study by Campbell McKnight reconsiders a date of about 1780, formally dismissed by scholars. This date is based on the record of Matthew Flinders, who encountered Macassan fishermen in 1803. He records a conversation that he had with Pobasso, a Malay chief. And here's Pobasso here. In this conversation, Pobasso recounts how he had been working in the Trepang industry for about 20 years and that he had been one of the first sent from Macassar to harvest Trepang on Australia's northern shores. In a voyage to Terra Australis, Flinders writes, Pobasso had made 6 or 7 voyages from Macassar to this coast within the preceding 20 years, and he was one of the first who came. In the past, the date of 1780 has been dismissed under the assumption that perhaps something was lost in translation. The conversations between Flinders and Pobasso were made through Flinders' cook. In any case, I think we can say that by 1780, there was certainly a Trepang industry in Australian waters, and that by this time, annual voyages were being organised from Macassar to the Arnhem Land coast to fish for Trepang. So who were the people making these voyages? Well, the men who made this annual voyage have become known as the Macassans, although they never would have referred to themselves in this way. The term Macassan has no racial, linguistic or cultural value. It is simply used to collectively refer to the people who made the annual journey from Macassar, port city in the modern-day island of Sulawesi, as I said, to the Arnhem Land coast. The purpose of the voyage was to collect and process Trepang to trade with the Chinese. Most but not all of the Macassans were Macassar, a linguistic group who came from the southwest corner of Sulawesi, and Macassar is situated there, so it's just down in the bottom left there. Other groups who form part of the Macassan fleets include the Bugis, and they're another linguistic group of southern Sulawesi, and their territory is sort of north of Macassar, as well as people from New Guinea and Java and Seram. And in fact, Campbell McKnight concludes that there was probably few crews that did not include some variety. What was common to the groups who formed the Macassan fleets was the port of Macassar. This was their base, so what was it like? Macassar was an entreport, an international place where people traded in a variety of products. In the lithograph on the left, it's by Jacques Guyard, excuse my pronunciation, you can see the European presence in Macassar in the architecture in this street view. And this was published in 1846. And on the right, in a lithograph, another lithograph by Cicero, the local architecture is represented, and Rue du Quartier Malay, so basically a street in the Malaysian, in the local quarter. And both original drawings are by Louis Le Breton. And finally, here is a portrait of a Chinese inhabitant of Macassar, again published in 1846 and thought to be a merchant. And so you can see by these series of images, all made during de Montdeville's expedition in late 1830s, there was a real international presence in Macassar. Macassar's status as a trading place grew because it was positioned in the centre of the Malay-Indonesian archipelago, and a fantastic location to catch maritime trade and traffic. By the end of the 16th century, a number of states had been established in southern Sulawesi, with the two related but different languages of Macassar and Bugis being spoken. The state of Gawa and Talor was the main centre of Macassar influence, while Bon, Wejo and Sopeng were the main Bugis states. During the 16th century, contact with the Portuguese increased. The port that grew out of this activity around the centre of Gawa and Talor became known as Macassar, reflecting the name of the local people. The following group of objects, which form part of the Australian Journey's display, provide glimpses of political, religious, and economic situation of this region during the Trepang industry. So here we have a ceremonial sword belt. It's a tablet woven textile made from cotton and indigo dyes. It was made in the 19th century. And here we have a pair of talismanic discs, and they're sculpted in gold alloy and cinnabar, and were made in 1903. And both of these items are in the collection of the National Gallery of Australia, and they're not archaeological, but these ones are. This is a VOC, or Dutch East India Company coin, or copper doit, and it's dated to 1780. And here are a couple of prunts from Dutch gin bottles. Both the coin and the prunts will be on loan from the magnet. And so what does this suite of objects tell us about Macassar? the place where the Macassans sailed from and where many of them lived and worked. In 1605, the aristocracy of Gao and Talo adopted Islam, and they also imposed a new religion on the Bugis states. Since this time, the predominant religion of the peninsula has been Islam. The sword belt and talismanic discs made in Sulawesi towards the end of the Macassan Trepang industry have Islamic references. The talismanic discs, which are believed to be for a sword belt, are decorated with Islamic calligraphy on one face, and the disc on your left is turned so you can see it. Allah is written in the central rectangle, while Muhammad is repeated in the points of the star. The other side of the disc shows off the fine filigree work. Woven into the sword belt is the Shahida, or the Islamic creed. At the start of the 16th century, the Dutch were establishing themselves in the East Indies. They wished to have complete control over the spice trade. The policy impacted on trade patterns of European and local traders, significantly depleting trade between the Moluccas and the western portion of the Indonesian archipelago. Consequently, Makassar became the port of choice, and its growing power frustrated the Dutch. In 1669, after decades of conflict, the Dutch took possession of the fort of Sombapo under the leadership of Admiral Spielman, and he's pictured in the cartouche on the top left. I'm sorry, it's not very clear, but there he is. And with the assistance of Bugis forces, led by La Tarutata from Boni, he's known as Arang Palaka, as he was known by the Europeans, and he's pictured in the top right. The Dutch renamed the stronghold Fort Rotterdam, and in this image, which is from the Atlas Amsterdam by Isaac de Graaf, you can see that the Dutch flag is flying high above the fort, and it's obviously denoting Dutch possession. This actual image dates from 1690 to 1705. Given that Macassar was ruled by the Dutch, unsurprisingly, Dutch manufactured goods were also found in Macassar, and some of these were brought to North Australia on the Macassan prows. So back to the gin prawns. The Macassan recycled Dutch gin bottles, most likely filling them with a spirit such as arak, and there are records of provision lists for prows that sailed into the north of Australia, which include arak. The prunt on the left is impressed with the brand name J.H. Enks with a stalk, and it was collected by Campbell McKnight from Wamanari Bay site on the Arnhem Land coast. On the right is a Blackenham and Nollet prunt with a key symbol, and this was also collected by Campbell McKnight from McPherson Point, South Goulburn Island. Coins produced for Dutch overseas territories, including Macassar, also accompanied Macassans on their voyages. A number of them have been found in archaeological sites across the north. This copper coin was excavated from a Macassan Trepang processing site on an islet just off Groote Island. It was minted in the Dutch province of Holland, as indicated by the crowned shield of that province on the obverse side of the coin, which is on your right. On the reverse side are the letters VOC for the Dutch East India Company and the year 1780. Presumably the coin was brought to Australia by the Macassans sailing from Dutch Macassar rather than by the Dutch themselves, given their archaeological context and the fact that the coin was produced for Dutch overseas territories, not the Netherlands itself. It also suggests that the coin was deposited on a voyage made after 1780. Although the Dutch had clamped down on the spice trade and restricted the trading capabilities of other European powers, Macassar, due to its position, continued to witness trade in a variety of products, particularly maritime commodities, from the southern and eastern parts of the islands, which now make up Indonesia. This included the Trepang trade. So what is Trepang? It's an echinoderm, also known as bechtermeer or sea cucumber. It's in the class Holothuroidea, and this class contains more than 1,000 species. These marine animals live predominantly in tropical waters, such as those to the north of Australia, and their lengths range from 10 to 50 centimetres, but sometimes they can grow up to more than a metre. They also range in colours, including black, white, grey, brown, blue and red. The use of the term trepang derived from the Macassar word teripang, and the word at the top there is actually teripang written in the Macassar script. And the term trepang is generally reserved for the edible varieties of sea cucumber. And one of these edible varieties, Holothuria scabra, commonly known as sandfish, is in the process of being preserved for the exhibit in the new gallery, which is why it's over here in this very attractive decor container. And you'll get a chance to see it, as Caroline said, afterwards. Touch it if you really want to. So Patria Kay is over there, is preserving it for us, one of our conservators. The animal, which was supplied by Tasmanian Seed Foods, is being kept in 70% ethanol. And what I understand, Patria, the Patria constantly measures the levels of ethanol in the container. And when, as the Drepang leaches out water, it dilutes that ethanol, so she continues to top it up with ethanol. And we'll keep doing this until it stabilises at 70%. And then it'll be ready to seal in the jar. Yep, excellent. And it's been going on for some time, I believe. Yeah. Anyway, sandfish were one of the species known to have been fished by the Macassans off the North Australian coast. And here they are here in their natural environment. This wet specimen was recently collected off a Groote Island and promptly gutted and blanched on board the fishing vessel before being frozen. So that's the ones over there. And this caused them to shrink from their original size. However, it was necessary to undertake this this course of action because of what I'm about to tell you. So I hope you've all finished your lunch because it gets a bit messy from here on in. If left untreated, sandfish will exhibit some seemingly bizarre defensive behaviour. Sandfish are known to expel their insides, their gut basically, through their back end. And if they're in distress. And presumably the predator goes for that gut rather than the animal itself, and the animal is able to crawl away. They can actually grow back the gut so that it's not fatal to them. And they can do this within 6 weeks. So if you look closely at this image, you might be able to see some intestinal type looking bits. Down the very bottom there's some. Up the top as well there's a couple of piles. Very attractive. Other species such as Holothuria atra or lollyfish, which was another species that were fished by the Macassans, exude a red liquor from their skin, which is poisonous to other fish. And then there are other species which actually disintegrate. That is, the body of the animal literally turns to liquid, or as basically you pick it up and it just... it loses all its binding properties and its body just sort of turns to liquid. When placed back in the water, it can reform. So it's also not fatal. But perhaps this is a way of entangling the predator. Not sure. I'm afraid I don't have a photo of that, but I do have a photo of this, which is a Drepang expelling its Cuvierian tubules, which are part of its respiratory tract, and they expel them through their anus. And these tubules become, they sort of lengthen and become very sticky. And as you can see, it could, again, probably to encase the predator. And again, not fatal, they grow them back. So, very interesting. So I guess this is one reason why the Macassans decided that they had to process the Drepang promptly after collecting them to avoid these sort of messy behaviours. But first of all, I'll tell you about how they get to Arnhem Land. The annual Drepang collecting voyage made by the Macassans departed Macassar with the onset of the northwest monsoonal winds, and these usually hit in December. So Macassar there is marked in the red box. Their destination was the Arnhem Land coast in the north of Australia, and that's an area they called Meragi. So you may have noticed that in the title. The Macassan word is Meragi for Arnhem Land. And there it is, written in Macassar script. From their home port of Macassar, they passed northeast of Timor, calling on the neighbouring island of Kisar, and that's marked by the green box. And here they picked up supplies of fresh water before embarking on the longest stage of the journey. It's roughly about 500 kilometres across open seas. And the Macassans crossed about 2,000 kilometres of ocean in total before making landfall in the vicinity of the Cobourg Peninsula, and that's sort of marked there in the blue box, that area. This journey usually took about 10 to 15 days, And throughout the season, they fished and processed Drepang, gradually making their way east to the bottom of the Gulf of Carpentaria, before returning to Macassar with their cargo on the southwest monsoonal winds, which usually blew in about April. The Arnhem Land coast is dotted with remains of Macassar Trepang processing sites, and all those dots along the coastline there mark sites that were surveyed or excavated by Campbell McKnight in the 60s. The Macassan voyage to Meragi was made on prows. The Macassans had different words for different prows, prow types such as Padawakang, which is a Sulawesi-designed and built prow, and these were used in the Macassan Trepanging fleets. And this particular one was captured off Raffles Bay in the Northern Territory by French artist Louis Le Breton. These vessels possessed anywhere from 1 to 3 tripod masts, and to which the sails were attached. Now, the sails were made from lengths of kararol, and a sample of which is on display in the case for you here today. But here's a photograph of it. And again, the word for kararol is in Macassar script at the bottom. It's manufactured from unspun fibres taken from the leaf of a palm tree, Korfa yutan, pardon my expression, and commonly known as gibang palm, among other names. The cloth is woven on a back tension loom used with a comb. The bundle of kararol on display here today was collected from Sulawesi by Campbell McKnight in the 1960s. There were three main legal interests in the Macassan voyages, and these were the prow's owner, the person who financed and outfitted the prow, and the captain who commanded the voyage. And the relationship between these interests was one of interdependence to ensure that all made their relative profits from a successful voyage. At times, these three roles may have been filled by just two or even one person. The financial backers of the voyagers who remained behind in Macassar might be Chinese, Dutch or Malay, while in most cases the captains were Macassar or Bugis. The crew members also had a vested interest in a successful voyage to ensure their own financial return. The voyage contract suggests that all crew members under the captain or master enjoyed equality, except that senior crew members were allowed to borrow more credit. This level of equality on board a prow is probably unlikely, however, and certain crew members were bound to have special functions. Once the Macassans arrived, they set about the businesses of harvesting and processing the Trepang. Now, the first task upon arriving in a bay was to establish a Trepang processing camp. If the site had been previously used, then the stone lines used as fireplaces for Trepang processing would indicate the most appropriate spot, so from previous seasons. And the location of these would have been known by some crew members or easily visible. Some sites were marked with a tamarind tree, and that's a species of tree that the Macassans introduced to the north of Australia. There were men who collected the Trepang, and there were those that processed it. The harvesting methods used by the Macassans were diving, dredging, spearing and spiking. Now, diving was reportedly the most common method employed, and the estimated depths by divers was up to 10 fathoms, although half this depth was probably more normal. Spearing was used in shallow waters, whereby trepangers walked about the shallows and either picked up the trepang by hand or speared them. And dredging is a method thought to have been introduced in the 1840s, and dredges were attached to the large canoes carried by each trepang. And finally, spiking, which involved the use of a ladung taripang, or a pronged harpoon. And here's one here. And this weighted tool was lowered over the trepang with the aid of a string. And this three-pronged example, which will go on display in Australian Journeys, was collected from southern Sulawesi in the mid-19th century. It consists of a palm wood handle, which at one end is inserted into a heavy piece of lead, with the corners attached by two rattan straps to the wooden base, from which protrude three brass points. So they basically, I believe, aimed above the trepang, let go, and the weight of the lead would drop it straight down onto top of the trepang. In 1871, Dr. Mather's Dutch missionary, who'd been carrying out ethnographic work among the Macassan people, gave the item to the National Museum of Ethnology in the Netherlands. And here it's illustrated in his ethnographic atlas, and I'm afraid it's a poor reproduction, but it gives you an idea of the tool with the actual rope and string attached to the end there. Trepang processing rapidly followed collection. Firstly, the gutted trepang were boiled in kawa or large iron cauldrons containing seawater. And in the exhibit, there will be two cauldrons, both on loan from Magnet. The first is this one, which, you can, as you can see from the label that comes with it, was collected from Record Point, Port Essington, in about 1909. And here's the second example, which will also be on display. This cauldron was collected from Sulawesi by the crew of Haiti Maragi, which is a replica prow built to commemorate the 1988 bicentenary. And this replica was sailed from the Northern Territory to Macassar and back again, and is now on display in Magnet as part of its boat display. This technology, the use of iron cauldrons to boil trepang, has continued in Macassar into the 21st century. After the trepang had been boiled, and this is depicted here in Melville's 1845 drawing of trepang processing at Victoria, Port Essington, they were buried in the sand. Historical informants report that the trepang was placed in a pit dug into the sand, and the hot water used for boiling the trepang was poured over it. The trepang were then covered with a layer of sand. After some time, the trepang were removed from the pit and the chalky skin washed away using salty water. The final stage involved drying and smoking the trepang. Drying could be achieved by laying the trepang on mats in the sun. However, if longer-term preservation was desired, and this was usual to get it back to Macassar, it had to be smoked over a slow fire. To undertake this task, smokehouses, examples of which can be seen again in the Melville image, were temporarily erected using bamboo and roof mats. Now a bit about the archaeology. The archaeological traces of these trepang processing activities are present along the Arnhem Land coast. The most obvious feature visible in the landscape today are the rows of stones which lined the fireplaces used in boiling the trepang. In many instances, these are still visible on the ground surface. Much less obvious, and only revealed by excavation, is evidence of the pits in which trepang were buried after being boiled. Now, they can be distinguished by the disturbed deposit. It is darker than the undisturbed sand around it. You can see a pit in this photograph. It's situated behind the stone line where the pole is sticking out of, and it's that deeper feature there. Finally, depressions in the ground surface and concentrations of pale grey ash within these depressions indicate the location of where smokehouses were in the processing sites. In the late 1960s, Campbell McKnight surveyed and excavated a suite of sites along the Arnhem Land coast, including the two sites in these photographs, Anaru Bay, and which is this one here, and Lauber, which was the previous slide. He drew on this archaeological work and, to a lesser extent, the historical and oral records to produce a picture of how processing site was laid out and used. There are, of course, variations between different processing sites, but in general, they were arranged as such. Stone lines marked where the location of the fireplaces over which the trepang were boiled, and then these were arranged adjacent to the shoreline, but parallel to each other, so if you can imagine that. The pits for burying the trepang were positioned parallel with and behind the stone lines, with the smokehouses positioned further back from the shore. Most trepang processing sites were usually situated on sheltered sandy beaches and headlands. The archaeology can also help tell us about trepang processing site use. For example, archaeologists may infer that a site was reused by a number of Macassan crews within or over a number of seasons, or used intensely based on the amount of material found in the site. This includes the degree of ash accumulations, numbers of stone lines and smokehouses, and the quantity and type of objects found, such as those made of earthenware, glass, china and metal. I should mention that there have been other archaeologists and historians who have carried out research on Macassan trepang industry in Arnhem Land other than Campbell McKnight, but my focus has been on McKnight because the archaeological objects featured in the display are from, as I said, the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory and from the McKnight collection there. So it's kind of appropriate to focus on his work. And he's one of the most prominent Macassan experts, and his research is sort of foundational and is still very relevant today and cited always. In processing the trepang, the Macassans turned this into this. And at the end, you'll be able to see the before and after as well. We've got them up the front here. The final product was taken back to Macassar and traded to China. As McKnight says, Drepang was the basis of direct contact between southern China and Macassar. And from the 17th century, there was direct contact between the eastern parts of the Indonesian archipelago and South China. Until 1820, a licence was issued each year in Batavia permitting a junk to sail directly from Canton or Amoy to Macassar. After 1820, no licence was required. Most of the small rice balls found on Macassar processing sites in Australia were probably imported from South China on such junks. There's an example of a rice ball in the case too, which you'll be able to look at later. More importantly, for the Macassans, the contact provided an outlet for their trepang, which made up an important part of the return cargo of the junks. Indeed, Australian trepang, which was almost unknown except at Macassar, was particularly intended for shipping directly to China. End of quote. So the Macassan voyages to the north coast of Australia were economic. The trepang harvested and processed on Australian shores was destined for the Chinese market, where it was in demand as a culinary delight and as an aphrodisiac. As you'll see, they're not very attractive. So. They don't look so appetising to me, but I guess different strokes for different folks. The amount of trepang collected off the Northern Territory coast and traded to the Chinese was not insignificant. Throughout the 19th century, it would appear that a majority of trepang traded from Macassar was supplied by the fleets which sailed to Arnhem Land, and perhaps even supplying about a quarter of the total Chinese market by the mid-19th century. The north coast of Australia, southern China and Macassar were all connected by an international trading network that centred on trepang. Harvested and prepared along the northern beaches of Arnhem Land, trepang was traded to southern China through the entreport of Macassar. In trepang processing sites along the North Australian coast, the Macassans left behind china produced in the kilns of southern China. Decorative motifs such as the chrysanthemum, circle and colon, and fish scales are repeatedly used and found in different sites, and examples of these will be used in the display in Australian Journeys. And now all of the following examples were collected by Campbell McKnight in the late 1960s. So firstly, we have a rice bowl, and that's looking down from the base. And this has the colon and circle pattern on it, and it was excavated from Anaru Bay. And this second piece here, which is oriented in a better position for you to see the motif, was recovered from Wamanari. And the rice bowl is here for you, as I said, is here for you to see today. Okay, secondly, we have the chrysanthemum design. And the piece on the left is from Wombalina Island, and the piece on the right from Anaru Bay. And again, this second shard is on display for you to see today. And finally, we have the fish scale design. And the two shards on the left are from Anaru Bay, and the third piece is from Layaba. And so you can see the motifs were spread out across different sites as well as being concentrated in one site, and in this case, Anaru Bay. And Anaru Bay is, in fact, probably one of the most important sites excavated by Campbell McKnight for the information it contains, and it was quite an extensive site too, so it's one of the main sites that he worked on. There will also be completed examples of 19th century kitchenware featuring the fish scale motif for comparison, or so that the design can be seen in a completed form. As you can see in this slide, the motif on the plate looks remarkably similar to that of the sherds, which were excavated from Anaru Bay. The plate, which was hand-painted with a blue oxide underglaze, was produced late in the Qing Dynasty, 1644 to 1911, and it was collected from South Sulawesi. The sherds are also from the Qing Dynasty, and it's difficult to pinpoint exactly which kilns these particular products came from, but we know they're from southern China. There has been a study done, but it's hard to actually pinpoint. You can sort of pinpoint it to a cluster of them, but not as hard just to pinpoint it to an individual kiln. The last Macassan prow to legally visit the waters of Arnhem Land was in 1905-1906. Only four prows visited the coast that season, one of which was captained by Yu Sing Dang Ranga. The industry had been in decline since the 1880s, when the South Australian government, who oversaw the affairs of the Northern Territory at the time, began to charge the Macassans customs duties and then a licence fee to fish in the Australian waters. In 1906, the government decided to ban Macassan-Trepang fishing, the main reason being, so they say, to protect and encourage the local industry, which I don't think at the time was as successful. In 1907, USINC again sailed to the Northern Territory coast to verify whether or not the reported ban was true. It was, ending an industry that had been operating since the 18th century and which brought Australia into one of its first international trading networks. Now, one thing I'd like to highlight before finishing up is that obviously the Macassans did not encounter an empty landscape when they arrived on the Arnhem Land coast. And it was of course, occupied by Aboriginal people. Now, the two groups entered into exchanges of goods and services, but the impacts of contact, I would argue, were more clearly visible in the material culture and the behaviour of the Aboriginal people than that of the Macassans. Now, for example, the Macassans introduced metal tools to the Aboriginal people, and these were used to build dugout canoes. Previously, they did have watercraft, but not watercraft that was as stable as a dugout canoe. And the dugout canoes actually allowed the Aboriginal people to venture further out to sea. And in doing this, they were able to catch more large sea turtles. And because they also had metal, then they used sort of their harpoons with metal heads, which allowed them to catch more. The significant increase in the number of turtles consumed by Aboriginal people after contact is visible in the archaeological record, as demonstrated by the work of Scott Mitchell in the 90s. The turtle shell was traded to the Macassans in exchange for more metal tools, among other things, and so the cycle of exchange goes on. I have not discussed this in relation to the exhibit because the exhibit will not be covering this contact. Now, I think it would take a whole another showcase to do it any justice, really. So I thought I'd focus my energy on the Macassans themselves, and particularly their Trepang industry, as one of the aims of the gallery is to focus in on the people making the journeys and the impacts of those journeys, the places connected by those journeys, and the people in those places on the central characters. It's all, you know, one of the aims of the gallery is also to look at the objects of those experiences, and probably the most important object of this exchange to the Macassans, to the sort of the exchange between Aboriginal people and the Macassans, was the right to fish for Trepang. And as pointed out in the example above, I think that the impacts of contact between Macassans and Aboriginal people on the Macassans was otherwise minimal. So the story of contact, I think, is a whole other story, but one worth telling at some point. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.